The Sewers of Paris is independent, ad-free, and listener-supported. Head over to patreon.com/mattbaum to join the folks who make the show possible and check out the rewards for backers. Hello and welcome to The Sewers of Paris. My guest this week has had a lot of jobs and a lot of adventures, from working on Broadway shows to producing the news alongside Dan Rather, singing to Angela Lansbury, earning a nickname from Fidel Castro, and writing the biography of Madeleine Kahn. William Madison knew he had a passion for creative artists from an early age, but there's no way he could have predicted how closely he'd work alongside them. We'll have that conversation in a minute. First, a reminder that The Sewers of Paris is on Twitter and Facebook. I post clips of the stuff that I talk about on each episode, and I hope you'll join me for our next fun-friendly live stream on March 21st. It's a laid-back brunchtime chat about the books and movies and music and shows that are bringing you joy right now. There's a link at the top of The Sewers of Paris Twitter feed. And by the way, if you like nerdy queer podcasts, you may enjoy my narrative comedy shows Queens of Adventure and Queens of Adventure Legends. Join us for an escape into a world of fantasy with drag queens playing Dungeons and Dragons. Queens of Adventure features an ongoing fantasy story with a regular cast, and Queens of Adventure Legends features recordings of live shows, one-shot adventures, and standalone stories with special guests like Ben de la Creme, Rock'em Sakura, Erica Clash, and many more. Subscribe to both shows at queensofadventure.com or search your favorite podcast app. Now, here's William. Well, this week I'm speaking with William V. Madison. Thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. Good afternoon.
So what is the entertainment that changed your life?
The entertainment that changed my life was one evening in May when I was 13 years old. My godmother took me to the opera. It was my very first complete opera. The star was Beverly Sills. After the performance,
we went
backstage, we met Beverly Sills, and I was so excited that the next day my mother had to keep me out of school. All I was capable of saying was, I met Beverly Sills. I met Beverly Sills. She was the most famous person I'd ever met. She was among the tallest. She had the hair and the eyelashes and the very large balcony, as we say in French. There was a crowd on her balcony. And she sort of bent down and reached for my program and said, would you like for me to sign this? And history does not record whether I was able to answer her. But I got her autograph. The next day was a Friday. The very next day was a Saturday. We went to the record store and bought my first opera recordings. Because of her, I studied French, German, and Italian. Because of her, I read books I never would have touched. Because of her, I became a journalist, because the next year she came to Dallas, where I grew up, and she was my very first interview. Not the high school English teacher about the literary magazine at the school, not the junior varsity coach about the big game. I interviewed one of the most famous women on earth, and everything followed from there. It's because of her, I think you can easily say, that I wound up working with Dan Rather at CBS. There is no doubt that that's why I wound up working with Teresa Stratus on the Broadway musical Rags. There is no doubt that that's why I wound up working at Opera News. And there's a pretty clear line to why I wound up writing Madeleine Kahn's biography. I have an affinity for coloratura sopranos, and Madeleine Kahn was certainly one of those. And worked with Beverly Sills a little bit. So there's quite a clear before and after. Everything I am starts with a performance of Rossini's The Siege of Corinth in Dallas, Texas, at the State Fair Music Hall in 1975.
Were you an opera fan before that?
No. My greatest exposure to opera was a school field trip for the first act of Pagliacci, when I was in sixth grade, and we were all excited because we were waiting for the tenor to sing No More Rice Krispies, which, if you're old enough, you remember that they used Vesti la Giubba, the tenor's big aria, Ridi Pagliaccio, was the melody for a Rice Krispies commercial, sobbing, No More Rice Krispies, yeah. We are out of Rice Krispies. So we were all very excited about that, but we didn't even stay for the second act. And other than that, my exposure to opera was entirely limited to watching Madeleine Kahn's close friend, Betty Aberlin, on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood when they did operas. So apart from that, no.
What happened during that show that suddenly you were converted into an opera fan?
It was everything you want when you are 13 years old. The plot of
Oh,
the Siege
I don't know about
Corinth.
Like
No, the plot of the Siege of Corinth is my dad hates my boyfriend, I'm going to kill myself. That is the plot. Every excessive emotion you could possibly want. I certainly understood why the Corinthians lost the siege, because they were all standing around singing while the Turks attacked. And so, of course, the next scene is the Turks storm the ramparts and take over Corinth. You know, this is, but it was thrilling. Plus, Rossini, you know, is a very elaborate vocal style, bel canto, it's called. And it is as exciting as any other physical display of virtuosity. It's like watching a great sport. So here you had not only Beverly Sills, but also Shirley Verrett, you know, extraordinary performers who could do anything with their voices, and the score required them to do everything with their voices. So it was as thrilling as a baseball game or, you know, the Olympics. As I say, it was everything you wanted when you were 13 years old.
Do you remember what you were thinking about during the show?
Gosh, I think I was so dazzled, I'm not sure I had any specific thoughts. It was mostly just, wow. I should say, my mother is a big musical theater fan. So I was prepared for the idea that people would sing when they were excited about something. That made sense to me. But as I say, you know, as far as opera goes, I had extremely limited exposure at that point.
You said that part of what was so exciting about it was that the whole vibe is my dad hates my boyfriend and I'm going to kill myself. Mm-hmm. What did that mean to a kid at 13? Like, was that relatable in any way?
At the time, I was still... Well, I mean, I hadn't even begun practicing anything, but I was still nominally straight, or trying to be. But I hadn't even declared my love for my girlfriend at the time. She actually engineered it so that her mother took her to the same performance, and we did both attend that performance. But I was pre-relationship. However, one's emotions are very... heightened, exaggerated when one is 13. And so the idea that one would overreact to parental resistance was very easily relatable.
Tell me a little about how you were growing up. You said it was in Dallas. Did you have a lot of like arts and culture in your life?
Well, we were very lucky because when I was growing up, the local opera company, in those days called the Dallas Civic Opera, and they dropped the Civic from their name several years ago, so it's now the Dallas Opera, was run by people who were friends with Maria Callas. In fact, Maria Callas actually launched the company. So we had a tradition of extraordinarily big stars coming to town to perform works that they might not perform elsewhere. And we were spoiled. I heard Marilyn Horne so often when I was growing up, I thought that's what all mezzo-sopranos sounded like. Spoiler alert, no, they don't. She has a very distinctive sound. And she also worked with Madeleine Kahn. You know, we had a short season of about four operas with the Dallas Civic Opera. And then every spring, the Metropolitan Opera would come to town, and that's who brought Beverly Sills into town for the Siege of Corinth, which was the vehicle for her Metropolitan Opera debut about a month before she came to town. So we had that. There was also the State Fair musicals, a summer musical sort of stock program that brought in interesting people. I saw Ricardo Montalban as the King and the King and I when I was a kid. That was pretty awesome. I saw Edward Mulhare as Henry Higgins in My Fair Lady, and he actually had replaced Rex Harrison on Broadway, so high quality. And there are also some art museums. Dallas likes to have art, in my experience and from my perspective, to say that it has them. or to do things to say that it has done them, to show off. Whereas other towns in Texas, Houston, for example, is much more adventurous and likes to try things to see whether they can be done. So there is a different mindset. But I spent my early years in Houston, so I had exposure to that art too, but I wasn't old enough to go to the opera when I was living in Houston.
Did people start to know you as like the opera kid after that?
Oh yeah. No, I didn't really understand how flamboyant I was as a teenager, but I would sing the med scene from Lucia in the hall, and yeah, that got me a reputation. I reconnected with my high school French teacher some years ago, and she said one of the things she remembered about me was my fanatical devotion to Beverly Sills. So yes, people did know me as the opera guy. And my high school journalism teacher, you know, I asked for permission to request an interview with Beverly Sills. I am absolutely sure she said yes, only because she thought there was no way Beverly Sills would do it.
Mm-hmm.
But here I am getting that interview because Beverly Sills' interest in self-promotion was a force of nature that should not be denied. And here I am putting Beverly Sills into the high school paper, something in which only maybe two other people in my school were interested. But I got away with it.
What, as you're like growing a little bit older and getting into high school, you said that you studied like a lot of languages and you're very invested in the music. What did you fill your day with? Like, what were your obsessions?
Well, my main preoccupation in school was journalism. I was the co-editor of the high school paper in my senior year. But certainly I would wake up in the morning and turn on the stereo to listen to music. I should say the study of languages, which I did pursue at school, was in part because back in the day, there were no projected titles at the opera. So you couldn't read read the English translation of what the singers were saying. You had to do a lot more homework in those days. And it occurred to me early on that if I started to pick up the languages, then I wouldn't need to do as much homework. I could understand it while they were saying it. And I left out Russian. I studied Russian too, but I was the worst student in the history of my school, and they asked me never to tell anyone where I studied because it's an embarrassment to us both.
Oh, no. But okay.
Yeah, I speak just enough Russian to get myself in terrible trouble.
What did you see as like your futures? Like, you know, as you left high school and went out into the world and went to college, what were you expecting to do with yourself?
I expected to be a novelist, and by golly, I gave it the old school try. It did not work out. My agent has forbidden me to use the word novel in conversation until he gives me permission, a thing which has not happened.
Mm-hmm.
But I sort of set out to have an interesting career, and at that I have succeeded, I think. You know, my first job out of school was with the Kurt Weill Foundation for Music. I became a Kurt Weill fanatic. Lotta Lenya used to appear to me in my dreams and give me advice about what to do at work. Because Lotta Lenya appeared to me in my dreams, there was one day when Teresa Stratus, the soprano, showed up at the foundation. She was a very dear friend of Lenya. She wanted to watch some videotapes of Lenya. I was the only person who knew how to use the VCR that day. So she was stuck with me. And I mentioned that, you know, I got these occasional visits from Lenya, and she suddenly whipped around. And years later, I said to her, that was the only reason you paid me any attention at all, isn't it? And she replied, oh, honey, of course. There was no reason to pay any attention to you. She then picked me up and took me with her when she made her Broadway debut in 1986 in a musical called Rags by Charles Strauss and Stephen Schwartz, with a book by Joe Stein, who wrote Fiddler on the Roof. And that was a tremendous adventure, getting to see a Broadway musical on the inside. At the time, we were the most expensive flop in Broadway musical history until Carrie, the musical, came along and lost more money than we did, which I think just proves that we didn't even know how to flop correctly. But I went from there briefly to Esquire magazine and then to Dan Rather's office. And from there to ABC briefly with Connie Chung, and then to Opera News, and then to my book projects. So it's been a checkered career, but mm-hmm. you can't say it was dull.
At what point, you mentioned that there, you know, you're, I don't know if closeted is exactly the right word, but like as a young teenager, you were attempting to be straight. At what point did, as a young gay man growing up in Texas, did you start to confront the possibility that you might be gay?
In drips and drabs. I really resisted. You know, there were sexual encounters with other guys, but I basically pretended they never happened. And the turnaround came during rehearsals for Rags. One of the rehearsal pianists was this incredibly cute guy. And I fell for him head over heels. And we had a brief affair. His name is Scott Frankel, and he is the composer of Grey Gardens and War Paint and many other wonderful pieces. We're still good friends, but that was sort of the turning point. He was so smart and so cute and so talented that I thought, well, even my parents can't have any objection if I have a relationship with him. Like, that, there's nothing you can say against him. So this will be okay. And that was the turning point for me. The summer before I had an affair with a woman, and after my affair with Scott, it's been all guys down the way.
How did your parents react?
I waited many more years before I came out to them. My brother, my only sibling, is also gay, and my mother reacted very badly to his coming out. So I waited. And my mother did not deal with it well when I came out either, but better. And she has since made astonishing progress, I think, for a woman of her background and her age. It was not a question, since I'm from the South, I'll jump ahead, you know, she's not a fundamentalist Christian or anything like that. It was more concern about how society would treat me. And so, you know, as she saw that society was treating me okay, she has come around really remarkably. And, you know, she's met my husband. She's doing okay. I'm proud of her, actually.
So you started your sort of like public coming out process while you were working on this big elaborate musical. Did you start exploring queer culture and like what is it exactly that gay people do?
I had begun exploring that already, and in a sense, some of, you know, gay literature was sort of dealt to me as a card because my early roommates included the novelists David Levitt and Randall Keenan, both of whom were openly gay. David, of course, was the very first New Yorker writer to treat gay subjects in this very overt manner that he did. He was the youngest writer for the New Yorker when he first published there. His first book, Family Dancing, came out while we were living together. He actually had the apartment below mine, but did take one room of my apartment for about a month during the couple of years that we were both in this sort of a almost a dorm situation with our early apartments, you know, up and down the stairs, in and out of each other's apartments all the time. So there was David, and casually tossing around all kinds of gay culture because that was what he was steeped in. And likewise, Randall Keenan, who was my roommate for about a year, had access to kinds of gay culture that were beyond me. He was the first person to try to get me to read James Baldwin, and I'm happy to say that about 35 years later I have done so. But it's not to say that every lesson took, I guess is my point. But a lot of gay culture was just there for the picking, And the question was how soon I picked it or picked up on it.
What sort of influences did you find? Like, was there other stuff that just like stuck with you and you're like, oh, this is becoming part of my like personal canon?
Tennessee Williams, certainly. Streetcar Named Desire, I saw when I was a freshman at Brown. And as...
What do you remember about that show?
Well, as a genteel Southern boy, or I fancied myself as such, to see Vivian Leigh, who of course had also been Scarlett O'Hara, to see the sort of ultimate Southern woman destroyed by this brute was deeply, deeply upsetting. And I spent about the next half hour sobbing. I couldn't go back to my dorm room. I just sort of wandered around campus. And the thought of suicide actually occurred to me. It's like, what's the point of even trying to continue because I'm doomed? Fortunately, I have moved beyond that. You know, I got it out of my system in about a half an hour, but it had a huge impact on me. You know, there were other things, other movies, for example, with good-looking guys, you know, that made an impact on me. The relationship between Mark Lee and Mel Gibson in Gallipoli, for example, was very inspiring, I guess. There were other... The Rocky Horror Show, for God's sake, spooked me the first time I saw it. I didn't know what was going to happen next, and what would people say about me if they knew I had seen this movie?
Where did you see it?
That I saw in high school in Dallas. And years later, I became friends with the son of the producer, Michael White. So that has been a kind of a nice through line in my
Where
life.
Were you when you saw the movie?
I wound up seeing it about... there were Saturday night screenings at the Highland Park Village movie theater. And I wound up seeing it about 13 times in 1 year. And then not again for 30 years.
Did you go with people?
Yes, absolutely. We had a little gang of high school friends who went to see it.
That really would have been like the heyday of going to see like in costume and with the shadow casts and everything.
No, actually, this was before then. We were comparatively respectful.
Oh.
I have attended performances now, and you can't hear the dialogue from the screen because everybody else is yelling and jumping around in front of the audience. We did shout out a few things. There were, on occasion, there were people who threw toast. But by comparison with what people do today, we were respectful, quiet, well-behaved. There were not very many people dressed up. It was before that stuff even took hold. I mean, I think we started going to see the movie about 2 years after its commercial release.
Well, I guess I just assumed that there was a brief period where it came out and wasn't really hitting, and then I think it was in New York that I read that people started going to see it in sort of a campy context. And I just assumed that kind of just took over by storm, but it sounds like it was a little bit more gradual.
Well, we were campy, but we just hadn't, you know, there are stages of it. And we were much more restrained than what would come later. It's also to be remembered we were in Dallas, which is much more conservative than New York, and we didn't invent this stuff. New York did. So, yeah, we did invent Monty Python. Dallas was the first public television station to carry Monty Python. But we did not invent Rocky Horror Show. So
so what brought you – you had like some of these artistic influences and you went to New York and you were working on the shows. What – it sounds like there was sort of like this pull between journalism, musical theater, opera, novelist. Where did you like – you know, as a young man, what did you like? How did you just describe yourself?
Oh golly, I'm not sure I did. I will say, you know, at Brown, you're allowed to build your own major. It's called the New Curriculum, and evidently, we are known for doing more than one thing at a time. If you compare us with other kids from other schools. So that I was always sure that I would be able to do more than one thing. The fact that I was working for Dan Rather did not prevent me from working on two different novels during my years with him. I would, you know, write when I was at home and then go into the office and write for him.
Well, how did that happen? I mean, it sounds like you just like had so many different jobs.
Yeah. with interesting people. I have. You know, and I actually, when I went to Opera News, I said I wanted to leave television and work in the opera world because at least there the prima donnas can sing. but as I say, I'd been at Esquire magazine briefly, and while I was there, I was in contact with an employment agency, which sent me to CBS, and there were two different openings at the time. One was in A&R at Columbia Records, and they took one look at my resume and my navy blue blazer and my khaki trousers and said, there's no way he can work in rock and roll, which I was deeply offended by. Of course I could. But the other job was at the news division, and they wouldn't even tell me what it was. So I didn't know I was going to Dan Rather's office until I wound up in Dan Rather's office.
What was that like? Like, what, when you finally realized what the job you were being considered for, like, it seems like kind of wild that you would go in for, I guess, an interview not knowing exactly what you were applying for.
It was exciting. I had a couple of blessings, I guess. One is that the woman who wound up being my supervisor was best friends in college with the girlfriend of one of my college roommates. So we had that, you know, connection. And then Dan is from Texas. So the callback interview was with Dan, and we talked briefly about the job. And then he said, is there anything that I ought to know? And I said, my mother will shoot me if I leave your office without telling you that I am from Texas, too. We wound up for the next 15 minutes discussing military strategies of the Texas Revolution. And when I walked out of his office, I thought, somebody else may get this job, but nobody else can do what I just did. And I got the job.
What was the job?
The job, I was with him for 12 years, so it evolved, but it started out, I was the second assistant in his office. And by the end of it, I was his producer.
Oh, wow. That's quite a climb.
Well, a lot of, I started writing for him actually during what turned out to be a hiatus. I went to graduate school. And Dan is a person who places great, great value in education. So the fact that I was a teaching assistant meant a lot to him. And also I got my degree in creative writing. So suddenly my credentials were greatly enhanced. And I had begun writing for his radio broadcast while I was in grad school. And when I graduated, he called me back to his office. And I became his sort of in-house editor. I helped him with speech writing and four books. Continued to work on the radio program and eventually became its sole producer. It was a remarkable collaboration. I mean, there were nights I would get home and I had heard his voice so much that as I fell asleep, it was still sort of reverberating in my head. I could impersonate him enough to do a mic check. It was a very close collaboration.
Did you, like, how much did you care about news, like the actual breaking, like, events day to day of, like, you know, some major thing has happened somewhere in the world and we've got to get to the bottom of what it is, versus some of the other work that it seems like you were doing that was far more, like, you know, with musical theater, a lot more creative, and with the biographies that you worked on, much more about the, you know, tracking down facts years and years and years after they happened.
Yeah, scholarly by comparison, studious. Well, I mean, certainly I grew up loving the news. I started reading the newspaper as soon as I could read. My father and my maternal grandfather both had short careers as journalists, so I was following in a family tradition. And then once I was at CBS, it was, of course, all-consuming. you know, I was at a cocktail party one night and my beeper went off, and because we had beepers in those days, this was a long time ago, I had to get to JFK Airport within the hour because Yitzhak Rabin had been shot. And I attended Rabin's funeral. So, you know, there was not really much opportunity not to be interested in the news because it had immediate impact on me. I kept a bag by the door for that kind of emergency.
I was going to ask, like, how often did you find yourself, like, in the middle of events as they were unfolding?
Well, depending, because, you know, you, if you're a news organization, you deploy your anchor carefully. So you don't send your anchor to every single event. But I went to, I think, 5 nominating conventions, 2 inaugurations, innumerable hurricanes. I spent a week with Fidel Castro, who gave me a nickname.
What was the nickname?
Yeah, El Nobilita, the novelist.
Oh, okay.
He would turn to his interpreter and say, ¿Qué dice El Nobilita? And with a Cuban accent, evidently you don't pronounce S's. My Spanish is terrible, but I had a nickname. And there's a wonderful photograph from the end of our stay. The night before we had had this, he and Dan had their principal interview, which lasted, I think, 3 hours or something. And then we went to dinner, which lasted for 3 hours. And it was very late. And then at the end of the evening, Fidel hugged everybody, which was his thing. So as we were, you know, the next morning we went to a hospital and we did some stuff there. And then it was time for us to leave Cuba. And Fidel approached me, and because he had hugged me the night before, I knew exactly what was happening. And because I saw our CBS photographer standing behind him, I knew that I was about to get photographed being hugged by Fidel Castro. And my father was in the Office of Naval Intelligence in the 50s, so big anti-communist. And I have this terrific grin on my face because I knew at that moment what my dad was getting for Father's Day. And I had the photograph blown up of, you know, Fidel Castro hugging me. And I captioned it, the threat of international communism has not abated. Your child may be next. Stay vigilant. Castro was extraordinary. When you were in his presence, you did not think about the terrible things he did. He had charisma like nothing I've ever seen. And, you know, when you think about it, he had to have charisma because otherwise he wouldn't have survived. But he was every man's brother, father, grandfather, and he was every woman's next lay. I have never seen anything like it.
Did you feel comfortable bringing up gay topics or LGBTQ topics to cover in the news? Like, is that something you could bring into the newsroom at that time?
I did. I was not out when I first joined Dan's office. There was one afternoon I decided it's Mardi Gras. I'm wearing beads anyway. I may as well come out to Dan. So I went to his office and I came out to him, and he had exactly the right response. I mean, as if he'd read a book on how to respond when your employee comes out to you. He and his wife began going out with me and my partner. We would have couples nights. He was perfect. Not everybody at the network was, and in fact, he warned me, you know, there are a few people here to whom you should not come out. Although I don't think it was much of a secret after a while. But yeah, there was certainly interest if I suggested a gay theme. There was a memorable moment when the evening news was interrupted by protesters from ACT UP, and that was actually during my graduate school years. And there was the odd sensation that I knew everybody on that screen. I knew the guys who were protesting from ACT UP, and I knew Dan. And I just wanted to take them aside and say, you realize Dan is not the problem.
Was that, I'm trying to remember. Yeah,
Dan is already giving you a platform.
Was that the group from Philadelphia? It was Mark something? Who stormed the news?
I don't know anything about Philadelphia, and I'm blanking on the names of the guys because, oh, well, Dale Peck was one of them, the novelist. Mm. And the other one, also novelist, and I can't remember his name, which is embarrassing, but I didn't know him very well. Dale Peck was a classmate of mine in grad school. And I'm sure there was somebody else there, but it's been a long time. But they were shouting, fight AIDS, not Arabs. So this was about 1990,
I guess. Okay. Yeah, oh, it was Mark Siegel, I think, did some kind of a zap on the news at some point. It was Mark Siegel from Philadelphia. But I think that must have been a different incident. I think that was somebody else.
Well, this was one of those, you know, certainly you can't get a lot more attention with a zap than on the national news.
Yeah.
So, you know, it got picked up in the papers, and as I say, I was in the odd position of knowing every single person in that shot.
So you were at CBS for about 12 years. Were you doing at the same time? Mm-hmm. Were you like working on other like side projects, personal things? Were you still involved in like musical theater?
Not really involved in theater, but my, you know, I was working on two different novels. That was very much encouraged by Dan. His wife actually read a lot of my rough drafts, which, God bless her. So, yeah, that was very much understood. There was not really any way for me to work on any theatrical productions. A lot of the time, I couldn't see shows because I couldn't predict my schedule. And if a show was a hit, such as Madeline Kahn and the Sisters Rosenzweig, I couldn't be sure when I was free, so I couldn't get tickets in advance. And I wound up not seeing the show at all until I saw it on videotape at the Lincoln Center Library.
What stands out to you as like memorable shows that you went to or were involved with during that time?
Well, certainly Rags was the heartbreaker. I had understood from Kurt Weill's experience when he came to the United States, he had the option of working in Hollywood, working in concert opera and classical music, and working on Broadway. And he realized that Broadway performers gave him the greatest potential to say whatever he wanted to say, that Broadway performers can do absolutely anything. They are much more versatile than opera singers were in those days, at least in his mind. Today we have, you know, astonishingly gifted opera singers who can do absolutely anything. But at the time that Kurt Weill got here, not so much. So here I was watching rehearsals of a Broadway show that was constantly being rewritten. And these people could field absolutely anything that was thrown at them. Comedy, tragedy, we had a juggler, I mean, everything, and sang like gods and goddesses. So to see them put this wonderful energy into this show and to see us become, for a time, a family, and to see the show not work out was truly heartbreaking, but unforgettable, educational, inspirational, and I'm still friends with many of the people from the show. And if I haven't kept up with them, I know that if I see them, we'll hug and cry. But other shows that had a big impact on me, I mean, there are all kinds of things. Angela Lansbury and Sweeney Todd was my first Broadway show. And years later, there was an event at the Museum of Television and Radio in Beverly Hills for Dan. And I finagled it so that Angela Lansbury would be the hostess. Originally, the idea was that it would be a roast, and so that was my way in. I said, get Angela Lansbury. She works for CBS. She won't make the network look bad. She can be very funny, but she won't be mean. And so she was asked, and she accepted. And then they decided not to do a roast after all. And she was a little confused as to why she was there, and the real reason was I wanted to meet her. So she introduced Dan, reading largely from his press bio, which I had written a great deal of, So I can say that Angela Lansbury has performed my work.
Congratulations.
At the end of the evening, how about that? At the end of the evening, I turned to my colleagues and I said, I still haven't introduced myself. I'm going to do that now. I had had one glass of wine, and it was white wine. It wasn't even the, you know, crazy stuff in the red wine. I went up to her, and I introduced myself. I said, Sweeney Todd was the first show I saw on Broadway. And the next thing I knew, I was singing Not While I'm Around to Angela Lansbury.
Oh.
I don't really know how this happened. I blacked out. And when I came to, I was in the middle of the song. So I caught myself and I said, you really don't need to hear me do this, do you? And she said, darling, it's meat and potatoes to me.
Oh, how absolutely
so
charming.
If I didn't already love Angela Lansbury, I had abundant opportunity to love her after.
That's just absolutely wonderful.
Yeah, that's definitely on my list of most influential performances and performers. She was unforgettable.
Well, it really sounds like you were ensconced around your heroes.
Well, I've been really lucky. I mean, Stratus, I had first seen in a TV film of Salome when I was about 15 years old. And I was simultaneously terrified and deeply, deeply aroused. There was a while when I was younger, if I heard her, there would be, shall we say, a conspicuous physical response to the sound of her voice, which made it awkward when we were working together. I had a huge crush on this woman. And then one day I was at my desk and there was a knock at the door and I answered the door and there was Teresa Stratus. And we became friends. So I was lucky, but, you know, New York, it does help to be in New York. And if you're interested in the arts, it does help to work in the arts. And if you're interested in news, it helps to work in the news. So you do wind up meeting all kinds of people.
Well, tell me about the biography that you did of Madeleine Kahn. That's how you how we were introduced, actually. It was somebody who thought I might be interested, and then they put us in touch.
Well, I had just seen my most recent novel manuscript rejected by every publisher, and my agent had forbidden me to use the word novel, urged me to find a nonfiction topic. And I was at a pretty low ebb, and I was sitting in my apartment in Paris, sixième sans ascenseur, which is to say a sixth-floor walk-up. So literally a garret in Montmartre. You can't get more bohemian than that. And I was watching YouTube clips. And for some reason, I landed on a Madeleine Kahn clip, and then another and another in the way that one watches YouTube clips. And for some reason, I scrolled down and I looked at the comments. And for most performers' videos on YouTube, you will find a lot of trolling, a lot of negative commentary, even if it's somebody like Ella Fitzgerald or Maria Callas, Judy Garland, there will always be people saying something nasty. In Madeleine's case, all the comments were loving and admiring. And I suddenly remembered the people who were Madeleine Kahn fans in college, and I thought, those people will read a book. So I started looking around. There was no biography of her. I managed to get in touch first with Madeleine's widower and then with her brother, and we were off and running. And it was a 7-year ride. I did not expect to spend 7 years with her, but I knew she would be good company.
Well, how did you, what is the process of reaching out to people and just to say, I'm a big fan, I like her work, it seems like a lot of other people do too, I want to write about her life. How do you, get in through the door? I know you had, a lot of credentials at that point with the kind of work that you've done, so I assume that helped?
Well, I was surprised. In fact, Madeleine's brother agreed to work with me so quickly, I stopped him and said, "Are you sure you know what you're saying?" Because he was legally liable. And I wanted to be absolutely sure. But his response was that because music was so important to Madeline, and because I had a background working with singers and at Opera News, I might be able to do a good job of this. That was why he trusted me. There had been one other writer, I am told, who had started to work on the book and had expected Madeline's mother to be more forthcoming. She was the only witness for a lot of Madeline's childhood. And she, in her later years, had severe memory problems relating to dementia. So when she could not help this other writer, he gave up, whereas I just kept going. I did actually interview Madeline's mother. She did not remember much, or said she didn't remember much. I think a lot of the memories were not happy memories for her. And the relationship she had with Madeline was complex beyond description. So a lot of mixed emotions, and easier just not to think about them. So to most of my questions, her answers were, "I don't know, I don't remember." But when it was time to go, I said to her, "Is there anything you want to say to me?" And she said, "Yes, I like you. You're handsome." And suddenly I understood her so well, because basically she was buttering me up, trying to get a good report in the book. And that this was the way she had dealt with men all of her life, and kind of the way she dealt with Madeline. I don't think she flirted with her own daughter, but she certainly knew how to manipulate Madeline and to work toward a desired end. So that was my meeting with Paula, was that.
Gosh.
I think a lot of the interviews came from other interviews. Madeline's widower had stayed in touch with a lot of people, so that he would set me up with people. The family, her brother, set me up with the whole family, basically. And then once I'd interviewed several people, you know, it sort of dominoed. I had to pull strings to get some of the interviews. Hal Prince was still angry about his experience working with Madeline and on the 20th century, you know, whatever it was, 38 years later, he was still angry and did not want to talk to me. But he was on the board of the Kurt Weill Foundation for Music, and I used to work at the Kurt Weill Foundation for Music. So ultimately, he couldn't say no to me. Bill Cosby used to be an interview you wanted to get. I had been living in France, and so I was unaware of a lot of what was going on. And this was also 2008, I guess, maybe 2009. But you know, a lot of the scandal had not hit the news, certainly not in France. Dan Rather got me that interview. Cosby had never forgotten that Dan had granted him an interview when his son Ennis was shot and murdered. And Dan reached out and said, "If you want to make a public statement, I'll take care of you." There was an interview on 60 Minutes. And, you know, any sort of professional affinity that the two of them had before as employees in the network certainly was enhanced by Dan's sympathetic treatment at a really, really low point in Cosby's life. So he said, "Absolutely, I'll talk to your guy." And my interview with Bill Cosby began with, "Hello, Dr. Cosby." And my next question was, "Thank you for doing this, Dr. Cosby. Goodbye." It was about a 75-minute Bill Cosby monologue. Remarkable.
Were there details that you learned about Madeline that were, I don't know, may not have been like the most salient details for the book, but like that were things that resonated with you, that were important to you?
Well, one thing was I was amazed that we had never met. It turned out that we knew quite a few of the same people. It turned out that we were at a number of the same events. You know, she worked on Broadway, in opera, on television. So did I. I'd never worked on a Hollywood movie, but, you know, I'm willing. You know, we had a lot of overlap. And so it was really remarkable to me that we had not ever met. We came really close. I think one of the things that made the biggest impact for me was simply how hard it was, even for an actress as established as Madeline Kahn, to pursue her career. And she had contemporaries, colleagues, friends, who had an easier time of it, but she didn't have what they had. One, obviously, Lily Tomlin, a very close friend of hers, was able to forge her own path because she could write her own material and because her partner, Jane Wagner, was helping her write her own material, and she could do solo shows. Madeline couldn't do that. And the other is Barbara Streisand, who was not Madeline's close friend, but they, you know, certainly worked together and knew each other, who was able to exercise a control over her career that, you know, Madeline could only dream about. Otherwise, it's really hard to be a working actress, and harder to be an actress than to be an actor, simply because it's hard to be a woman. She had to put up with all kinds of stuff and work on projects that she did not like because she had to make money because she was supporting her mother. It was a really difficult career and not always happy, which made it sadder, I think, that she didn't really understand how much people loved her. When she died, all of New York seemed to clasp a hand to the chest and say, "Oh, I loved her." She had no idea that people felt that way about her. And I don't know, it might have made it easier for her if she'd known.
Huh. That is really surprising to me that it wasn't more evident.
Hmm. Well, as I say, I've known a lot of actors in my life. So it's not a complete surprise that it's a tough life for an actor. But in her case, it was much harder than I realized. And again, you know, her first movies, right out of the starting gate, were such huge hits. And suddenly she was well known, and within a couple of years, people were describing some of her performances as self-parody. Well, to know that it's a self-parody, you have to know what the self is. You know, she had already become so firmly registered in the public imagination within just a few years of her movie debut, that she then found it really difficult to find work. And, you know, not a news flash that for middle-aged actors, it's harder. That was true of her. For women, it's harder. You know, she was obsessed with her appearance for reasons that didn't entirely have to do with her career. But, you know, she was obsessive about her appearance, because she wanted work, and she knew she had to look good to find work.
What was the response from the people that you spoke to and from the family when the book was done?
Her brother called me after he finished reading the book, and we had a good cry. My aim was to write something that was worthy of her. She would never have consented to my writing a book about her while she was alive. But my aim was to take her seriously as an artist. My focus was on her work. I know there were some people I talked to who were worried at first that this was going to be some sort of scandalous tell-all. And it's not, for one thing, because there's not really any scandal. And for another, because I don't think Madeline wanted to be remembered by her love life. I think she wanted to be remembered by the work she did. She was very serious. I didn't even fully understand when I wrote the book. She was a method actor, which in a Mel Brooks movie is kind of insane. You don't need those skills or that approach, or so you would think. But how she got so invested in those characters and how she was able to pick up on tiny things comes from her very serious approach. There's a moment in Blazing Saddles when she's just had her ecstatic night of love with Cleavon Little, and he's just left her room. She closes the door, looks upward, sighs, and says, "What a nice guy." And because she was such a serious actor, that line is invested with so much feeling and so much context. Suddenly you know that in Lily von Stupp's ridiculous life, most of the guys were not nice. And you get that from one line. She was an extraordinary performer. And that's what I wanted to really bring forward. To bring forward the degree to which music was important to her. The way that she would take a script and treat it as a musical score. And basically sing it, I did not think was fully appreciated. And that was something I really wanted to pull forward.
It sounds like in a lot of your work with interviews and working the news and producing for Dan Rather and writing biography of Madeline, that a lot of your focus is on presenting a portrait of a person and giving people not just a sense of who they are as people, but I don't know, in making a presentation of someone so that strangers can get to know them more clearly. I mean, is that something that's been important to you?
Well, absolutely. The word I used was voice. I wanted Madeline's voice to be heard. Not only because she was a singer. So it was very important to me to talk to as many people as I could until I had to stop because I had too much material. There were a lot of people I still would have called. There are some regrets that I didn't get to some people. But I wanted to talk to as many people as I could. I got at least one eyewitness to virtually every project she ever worked on. I wanted to quote from her at length. There is a school of thought in writing this kind of book that you have, you know, you pick out just the most important words from any quote. And I wanted to give the full quote as often as possible. Again, because Madeline's voice needed to be heard. She worried that people who had seen her only in the Mel Brooks movies would have an expectation of her that she couldn't live up to. She was not bawdy. She was not, you know, broadly funny. She was sort of dryly witty. You know, she was not Lily von Stupp. She was a genteel young woman from the Upper East Side by the time she made it to the Upper East Side. So she was actually nervous around her fans because she thought she would disappoint them. They would want her to be Lily von Stupp, and she couldn't do that. But that also meant that they didn't get to hear who she really was. And because the parts she played were very seldom anything like her at all, it was very important for me to give her voice to the reader.
Do you feel as though you've had opportunities for your voice to reach people?
Well, it's funny. There's a conversation in the movie Can You Ever Forgive Me between Melissa McCarthy and her agent, played by Jane Curtin, where the agent talks about how little of Melissa McCarthy she gets when Melissa McCarthy writes about other people, and Melissa McCarthy says, "It's my job to give you my subject, not myself." Certainly in the Madeline Kahn book, I felt that way. The book is guided by my background and my interests. The words are mine, but I'm more interested in letting you see Madeline than I am in showing anything about myself.
Are there...
I guess that answers your question.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm just curious because, you know, as you said, starting off like as a novelist, that's very much about like making your voice heard. And it sounds like, or at least finding a voice that you know, maybe not your own, but like creating a voice. And it sounds like where you've really shone is in ensuring that other people's voice can be heard.
Well, that's coming from journalism. You know, the journalist's job is not to be the star, which is harder to remember in TV because, of course, they see your face. So you know, the rules automatically change. In print, it's different. But, you know, get the facts, tell the story, and keep yourself out of it is the rule of journalism, largely, traditional journalism. So I came at it with that approach.
Are there lessons that you learned from, like, studying the life of, I mean, you know, Madeline was obviously a big focus for you, but maybe from other people, but, like, are there lessons that you picked up from your subjects that you apply to your own life now?
Well, I guess if you go all the way back to Beverly Sills, she underwent a lot of hardship in her life, a lot of challenges. You know, both her children were born with disabilities that were really challenging for Beverly Sills and for her whole family. And somebody asked her once, "Are you happy? And you seem happy all the time." And she answered, "A happy person has no problems. I'm cheerful, and I choose to be cheerful." And that is a lesson I try to keep in mind. I'm not very good at it, I have to say. But, you know, certainly that's a lesson I heard early and have carried with me ever since. Get the money up front was a lesson that Teresa Stratus tried to teach me. Again, not sure I learned that well enough. It's, yeah, it's not so much about lessons as about a sense of the people. I'm very tender toward Madeline Kahn now in a way that I would not have been if I hadn't spent so much time delving into her story. And in the case of somebody like Teresa Stratus, I am, you know, I was a fan before. I am devoted to her in a different way now because I have worked with her, because I have seen her develop a character on stage. I have seen her learning music. I have seen her practicing and looking for the truth of the character she's playing. I would not have understood that the same way if I'd never worked with her. You know, certainly if you see her performances, you know she's striving for the truth, but you don't see her do it. And you don't see her try one thing and then realize that's not working and try something else. So the whole process is revealing and meaningful to me in a way that it could not have been if I hadn't worked with her.
Well, so if people want to have the experience of diving deeper into her life and checking out that book, where they find the biography and check out your other work?
Well, the biography is, the exact title is Madeline Kahn, Being the Music, A Life. It was published in hardback in 2015 and in paperback in 2016. The paperback does have a couple of corrections and updates. It can be found at your local independent bookseller, who will be happy to order it for you, or you can get it from Amazon or that sort of place. It is available as an ebook. And my full name is William V. Madison. I also edited the memoir of the glorious Czechoslovakian soprano Jarmila Novotná a couple of years ago. Her book is called My Life in Song. Her name is spelled Jarmila. Novotná is Novotna. She was Montgomery Clift's co-star in his first feature film. She was the person for whom Cole Porter thought he was writing Kiss Me, Kate. She was actually attached to that project before he was. So, you know, above and beyond opera, she had a remarkable career. She was also an ardent Czechoslovakian patriot. She was intimately connected to President Tomáš Masaryk. She knew everybody. The Duke of Windsor used to play piano for her when she sang. She was an incredible character. So that's another one to look for is My Life in Song. And I like women with pretty voices, so those are some books that I've worked on. Madeline Kahn and Yarmila Novotna. There is a through line there.
Well, William, thanks again so much for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm humbled to have been given the opportunity to talk so long. I hope anybody wants to hear it. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, and thanks to William for joining me. We talked a bit about those times when queer activists have interrupted live news broadcasts, and for my recommendation this week, look up Mark Siegel and the Gay Raiders. In 1973, Mark was able to talk his way into a CBS news studio, posing as a student, and then he barged in front of cameras during Walter Cronkite's broadcast to protest the network's prejudice against gays. He was quickly dragged away, but Cronkite's interest was piqued, and the two began a dialogue. Not long after, CBS aired a segment on expanding rights for, as the news tended to put it then, homosexuals. Mark's disruptive, aggressive actions were effective, a model for increasingly bold demands for equality throughout the 70s and into the unimaginably turbulent 80s. Thanks again for listening, and thanks to everyone who's reviewed The Sewers of Paris on your podcast platform of choice. That really helps people find the show. I post clips of the stuff that we talk about on each episode on Twitter and Facebook. Reach out and let me know your thoughts on the show at sewerspodcast@gmail.com. The theme song for the show is Parisian from filmmusic.io by Kevin MacLeod of Incomptech.com, licensed under Creative Commons by Attribution 4.0. And until next time, croissant.